recording now.
And just when we decide to record, they start to drill right outside my place.
In the heart of Toronto's construction district. Which is the whole city. That's Toronto. Wink, wink, to anyone visited in Toronto.
So this is the podcast with the celebrated, very funny man, Andy Kindler. You hooked this up, man. So kudos to you for doing this.
Thank you. No problem.
For the Just for Laughs Toronto Festival.
Thank you, Andy, for being willing, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was a bit nervous because he is a very, very, very funny guy.
Oh, and GFL42, thank you to Jackie for your help. Right?
Yes, Jackie was very helpful. She hooked this thing up.
Really, yeah.
And, you know, Andy Kindler, very funny man. I've seen the interview you did with him. You interviewed him
a few years ago.
Yeah,
I think when I was just starting to kind of know him a bit. Yeah,
right. And since then, you guys have
we've done more shows together.
Right.
Yeah.
I was really nervous because I'd seen some interviews with Kindler, yours, but other ones where he basically makes fun of the whole podcast, almost not DIY. I hate to use that term, but like. Just the amateurish nature that podcasts can be at times, and the people who do some of these YouTube channels or podcasts, there's a whole lot of dressing to their channels and everything. But then when you look at the views, there's like 300 views, and it's been up for 17 months.
Right, right.
And Kindler is very aware that he is basically wasting his time doing these things. And he makes it known to the interviewer.
But that is his style. He's like slightly a needler. I mean, but it comes from a place of affection. So
yes,
I think
it is.
That's why it's worked for so long, long as it has. Although it's gotten him in trouble, I think, too.
Yeah, yeah. And I think he makes a mention of it in this episode.
He's known. Andy is known in comedy circles. I don't know how much in like large scale circles as sort of the like in-house critic of comedy, if that makes any sense.
Right, he does the what do you call this? He does the
state of the industry address.
State of the industry address
at Just for Laughs in Montreal every year. Yeah,
and there he basically targets a whole bunch of comedians and a whole bunch of actors and a whole bunch of whoever. Yeah.
And he also does material. He just sort of will do some jokes, you know, that isn't even about anybody.
I just didn't want to get in his crosshairs, and so I mean,
it's kind of an honor to be in his crosshairs. Sort of, he makes that distinction in the interview, right? He talks about that a bit, and
but I just wanted him to know, like right off the bat, that hey, it's good to do this podcast.
This is serious stuff.
Yeah, we're serious.
There's a Finnish person will become your fan because of this podcast.
Right, you know, who knows? But also, you know, meeting Andy through you.
Yeah.
So I guess I had good association in his eyes. So that was a good start.
He's like one of the most engaged kind of people I know. He's always very, very attentive and, you know, responsive. So it's like, it's always great.
Within all the funny, he is engaging.
And he's so funny. Yeah, he's always, you know, coming up with the ha-ha words.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it's funny how people, when I see other people with you,
yes,
it's interesting that it's a very similar dynamic that you and I have, because he immediately knee-jerked into this whole, like, let's rip on Flanagan. And then he caught himself doing that, and he apologized sort of in the middle of the podcast. Okay, so I'm not too far off when I write to you. In bold, angrily.
I've never had anybody write to me angrily in bold. That's never happened.
Have I not done that to you?
You've done that, yes. So that element of the dynamic is different. But I don't know if he has that kind of a, you know, needing to write to anyone in bold kind of relationship with anybody. You know.
Well,
a comedian is one man. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, maybe he should start doing you.
Except maybe he's written this. Maybe he's written this before. I love it. In bold, yeah.
Right.
That might have happened. But yes, but at the same time, I do think he detects I'm trying to think of what he sees in me that, like an aloof neediness.
Punching bag quality?
Yeah, like this sort of like needy, but a little bit like angry,
angry, like, that you're needy.
This young, but he says really nice things to me all the time.
I think he genuinely. I mean, you can hear it. He genuinely likes you.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Off really the mic, it was, he definitely liked you, and it was all good. And I think he enjoyed.
Me and my friend Tim are like, we just love Andy Kindler, and Andy loves my friend Tim Gilbert a lot too. Not that I should speak for Andy here, but it seems like he does, you know. And that was a good thing when we went to Just for Laughs this year. And he put us on the alternative show. He put us both on these like great bills for the alternative show, which is this show he runs at Just for Laughs. So he does this State of the Industry thing. And then he sort of MCs a show called The Alternative Show that they brought to JFL 42 this year. And it's always a crazy lineup. You know, the show I did was like Tig Notaro, Mark Maron, Colin Quinn, Greg Fitzsimmons, you know, Nick Kroll. Like, it was all of these huge names. And I think that's because he has... He sort of started at the same time as a lot of these people who rose to prominence, and he's an alt comedian in like the old sense of the word, if that makes any sense. Like, he sort of helped define whatever that was. It's just like whatever sells, you know. Like, Mitch Hedberg was strange, but I think was beloved across the board. I mean, really, yeah. Anyway, so and here's Andy Kindler.
Yeah.
Mitch Hedberg was very well liked. Here's Andy Kindler. Enjoy.
Okay, we're here. It started.
It's on.
Thank you for being patient with us, Andy.
I can't even believe it. I am just enraged. Is my level okay, or am I going too high?
No, you're great.
What if I go back like this?
You're great.
You know, a lot of the kids today don't know. If you're going to do something like that, you back off the mic. Yeah. The kids don't know it. Don't overload. Don't overload it. Don't put it in the red. It's digital. Keep it at minus 3 dB and enjoy yourself.
Can I try it?
Yeah.
Andy, do you want to restart your career?
You're not supposed to yell as if you're not yelling. You go, Andy, do you want to restart your career?
Andy, do you want to restart your career?
Unbelievable. This kid's going to take a lot of seasoning.
I do need seasoning.
You need seasoning is what you need.
Tenderizing?
Well, you need also to be flattened into a patty.
Sure, please do. Flatten me.
You guys played together last night, or what do you call it when comedians...
We call it jazz. We call it dubstepping.
Yeah, we did some dubstep jazz.
We call it jazz. Everything. What we like to do, comedians like to do, is compare everything to jazz, which most comedians have no knowledge of. Yeah. It's right. Like jazz, man. Like Kenny G. We're like Kenny G up in here.
Yeah, it's like I'm bebop.
I would have bazaba. What's up with Malls?
I'm just scatting up there, you know.
Yeah. Also, when I perform,
a lot of scatting.
Was that mean? It's blue, too blue. I put my ear. I do this when I'm performing, like they do in the old when the harmonizers. They do that to hear their own voice.
Well, because there's no monitor.
Is it a pitch check?
Oh, so they don't have to do that anymore.
I don't think so.
It's easy. Are you one of these musicians who plays with a thing in your ear?
No.
Okay.
I'm against that.
No, I don't mean like to silence it. I mean to hear it.
Yeah, yeah. Like in-ear monitors.
Yeah.
Yeah. No,
drummers have to have it though, or they...
Some of them do. I mean, yeah. I don't know. Or some of them use it to have the click in their head.
Right.
You know, so they can... Because a lot of them have problems with tempo.
I found in that... And I don't want to just make it about me... You know, right off the spot. I want to.
It is about you today.
But when I was in bands, and first of all, I'm so old, and this is my thing. I think I should just preface every joke with. Now, of course, I'm old, but we used to have the Dr. Rhythm. I don't know if you even remember what it is. It's an antique.
Yeah, it's the thing that keeps the beat, right?
Yeah, but it had like settings like rumba, bossa nova.
Yeah,
and it sounded like someone had taken an AM speaker, busted it. And beat like a drum over it. But then we had click tracks too.
I think people are using those exact sounds today
yeah,
to make
to be cool.
new yeah to make so, new songs.
Okay, and, click tracks. When you say we had click tracks back then, what's like? Maybe am I? In, what is a click track?
Well, a click track is, and you of course could explain better, but I show that I'm in your neighborhood.
Yeah.
No, it's just a, it's like a metronome. It's a beat that goes off because yeah. drummers do. Mm-hmm. Did you see that movie? That was a. I didn't see the whole movie, but it was a documentary about that a recording studio and Dave Grohl.
Oh, Sound City.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
I
Dave
did.
Grohl was explaining. Like,
we've actually recorded in his studio.
In the sound, in the oh, in Dave's
when before he had that board that
right.
movie is about.
And that board was famous. It was in L.A. But like they talk about making the Nirvana album and how he was so angry about it because the guy was saying he was his beat was slowing down and he was like, well, I should be able to slow it. But then he used the click track and it seemed to work.
Yeah, I mean, I guess when I know what a click track is. I was just wondering, like, what is it made of? You know
oh,
I mean?
So yeah, you, yeah, oh, yeah. this whole time yeah. you were going for some ridiculous joke.
No, I wasn't.
What do you mean, what's it made of? They make them out of bamboo now. What are you asking exactly?
Like, is it like a doctor?
It's a guy, it's a small guy who's paid to be in a studio
yeah.
who has, like, you know how perfect pitch? He has perfect click.
It's perfect.
And he just goes.
Well, there's ringers that are brought in, like drummers who have perfect tempo. And, you know, you don't know about them because. You know, the band doesn't want that known, that their drummer in the photograph isn't the drummer on the album.
Right.
But there's studio drummers who come in quietly and play the whole album.
Quietly? That sounds like an oxymoron or something.
Skulk into the studio.
Yeah. Oh, not when they're playing, though.
No.
But why don't they kick the guy out who's dragging and,
it's happened before.
And think and pick the... well, but does that mean if you have perfect tempo that you necessarily... But you may not have soul, right?
Yeah, that's an argument. I mean, that's a conversation we can have because some of these drummers are so good because they have both. And they're in five bands plus all the studio work. And they're like more in demand than the bands that they play with. You know, they're more sometimes more known. Like, for example, Josh Fries is someone
yeah.
who is a drummer that I'm thinking about.
He drummed with Devo on the last tour that
Replacements.
Devo did. Yeah.
He's on tour with the Replacements right now. Guns N' Roses. And then he's in the Vandals as well. That's his band, right?
The members. The pumps don't work because the Vandals took the handles.
Right. It's about the Vandals.
You know what the song that is? That's, your kids don't know your history.
Yesterday you said I looked like Bob Dylan.
That was Subterranean Homesick Blues.
Yeah.
And Nick said, who's Bob Dylan? Is that what
No, he
said?
Knows. Nick's one of these kids who, when he was 9, he was walking around saying, I like vinyl.
Close. Very close.
Yes.
12.
He buys podcasts on vinyl.
Yeah, I do. I want the WTF collection on vinyl.
Why don't you have a podcast?
Yeah,
why
a
podcast. Don't I have anything going on? You know what I'm saying? I finally made a deal with AST Records. I don't like to brag. But I'm finally making my first CD. I made a DVD in 2003.
Yeah.
But this is my first actual CD, which I'm very excited about.
And we've had comedians on this podcast before, and I have brought up this discussion with various comedians, and that is how a band has a cycle with their album. And then over a span of 2 to 5 to 10 years, you have a discography. But
yes.
with a lot of comedians, it's just, you know, they might be very well known, very well respected, and very seasoned, but their discography is...
Two albums.
One album, two
albums. I put out one album, and I remember I was talking to a comedian once who was, like, older than me, and he was just like...
Who isn't older than you? You know what I'm saying?
Everyone's older than me.
I wish I were
12.
I know. It's over for you.
It's over.
Your young guy thing is dead now.
Yeah, yeah, I can't be like a kid.
Oh, I don't even know how to put a coin in the meter.
That was my 20s material.
But I would think... I'm sorry, I interrupted you. So you were saying about people...
No, I want you to... What were you going to say?
He interrupted me.
Yeah.
Well, then let's... No, I was going to say, I think there are people who are... I don't know if it's I don't even think it is a generational thing, but there are comics who are more prolific in terms of CDs. Like Todd Barry has a number
well,
of
it was
CDs.
Todd, who I was talking to, I was going to say, like, when I told him I would put out an album, he was like, how long have you been doing comedy? I was like, 10 years or something. And he said, okay, that's fine.
Yeah.
You can put out an album in 10 years. Because there
it's
is
the opposite
comedy.
For bands. Bands put out 7 inches before they
right.
play their first
demo,
club
single,
show.
And then the first album.
Well, that's your only, yeah. but because bands, that is your expression. You know what I mean? Like your expression, if you're going to put out something, it's... Well, I'm sure it would be good for any band to have experience playing together first, but it's more directed towards some kind of product that you can listen to in some form, whereas a comedian could be just working on material and doesn't necessarily have to produce something just by nature of being a comedian. I wish I was articulate and or was at a point.
He's showcasing. He's showcasing himself.
Yeah.
Place to place. So the act is existing and changing. That's another thing. It's changing so much a lot of the time.
I understand it's hard.
Even if you have an album out, sometimes like I have this record out and I'm like, I don't want to retire this material. Hardly anyone knows I have an album. You know, if I ever were to do like a TV thing, I almost want to, or a bigger show, like an hour show, I'd almost want to combine that stuff into what I have.
I think I have the answer though. Here's the answer to the question. I think I actually have nailed it down. It's that stand-up comedy is counterintuitive to any kind of other art form. So, like the Beatles, like from my when I was coming up, I thought when I was 21, I was a failure because I came up from a generation where you had the Beatles, you had Bob Dylan, you had all these people. And there's something about performing music, especially rock music, where that kind of doesn't always have to be that this way, but that youthful. You know that Bob Dylan song, I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now. It's like the idea you're so opinionated at a certain point in time, and that can be channeled into very explosive, great music. But comics is different. What Todd was saying is you need 10 years to even be, unless you're like a phenomenon like Dave Chappelle or a couple of other examples, mostly it's not that way. You need a lot of time, even if you're funny the first day you get on stage, to develop it at the point that you would want to put on a CD.
To either have a perspective or like be able to express
more aligned with like a writer.
I think a writer would be a good analogy. An author. And 28 years, I've been doing comedy, I think 28 or 29 years, and I feel like about 5 years ago, I made this big breakthrough, which I've told the story a million times, so it's probably boring, but I thought I was always saying everything that was on my mind on stage, but I realized I wasn't. I was mostly getting angry at the crowd or making fun of myself, which I still do. Not so much getting angry at the crowd. I don't do that as much anymore. But I realized that there were a lot of thoughts in my mind that I just wasn't saying, not because they were blue or anything, and that opened me up as a comedian. That was 23 years into doing it. So now I say everything. You know, I might say like, oh, you people didn't like this half-baked idea I came up with 2 hours ago. You know, and it's not foolproof because sometimes it can get annoying, but it kind of loosens up the moment. Mm-hmm. And so I really am being in the moment. So that's what very few musicians, I would say, would, you know, well, I don't know. Maybe there are late bloomers with musicians too.
Well, you know, I just feel that with comedians and their material and how it's constantly changing, like you said, Nick, I feel that because you are a party of one, you travel by yourself everywhere, you don't have that, maybe you do, but you don't have, not everyone has that person to bounce off of and say, okay, this is the slate right here. Cap this, capture this, and move forward.
It's always a thing of
I can do better than that. I can do better than that. You just never cap it. Like, for example, if we're in the studio, I can do vocal takes for days and days and days, but there's a producer there who says, we got it. Let's move on.
Well, I think that, to the degree that I do voiceover auditions, which any voiceovers I've gotten have not been from auditions because the voiceover world for like commercials or whatever is so restrictive. It's worse than any other part of the entertainment industry. They're like, to me, they're like so by the book. There's so few that are good. But I know it's a lot of these people who do them. They do them like on their own home thing, or they have the blue microphone. They do it, and I can't stand that because I need somebody. I just
thank you for that.
You want a free blue microphone?
Yeah, yeah. They might have a blue. I mean, I don't know what they're using, but I enjoy the blue 3E XJ K series with the manual mute override. So. But I need, like for voiceover especially, I need someone in the booth who I get along with and can say, because I don't really know how it sounds. So I think that's different than that. It would be a difference between
music.
Wouldn't
that be the best comedy album ever? Like you're in the booth and a guy's like, no, take that.
Albert Brooks did. I mean, Albert Brooks was revolutionary in the way that he combined live stuff with recording.
I think that would be awesome. That thing in the 70s and 80s too, where that was happening more with just like bit skits
yes.
and sketches.
Isn't that more of a 70s and maybe an 80s thing?
Sandler kind of keeps doing that, right? Like Adam Sandler's.
But they're all like songs, right?
No, there's sketches on those. Lots. Yeah,
but there's no stand up.
And why on Adam Sandler?
No yeah.
I didn't know that because I haven't listened to one. But no, that's a little backward slam.
Boom.
I mean, it's not like his quality suffers as opposed to the blue.
Unfunny
which you can,
people.
The blue microphone.
Unfunny people.
More like
unfunny people.
Well, but one thing I will say is that grown-ups too. Will these guys ever grow up comedically? But one thing that I'm very excited about is that I listened to Mitch Altogether, which is
a great record.
It's such a great record. And that got me, and I've talked to a lot of comics about this and a lot of people who just listen to comedy, that got me very excited about doing a CD.
Is that with the bass playing, with the stand-up bass?
No, that was the first one.
Okay,
the second one is not like that. But he's very, I mean, both are great CDs, but the second one I particularly like, where he's really in the moment and he's referencing other things and he's talking about making a CD. So I like that. There's some experience where it's more authentic. It's more like, in a way, it's not like listening in a club, but I've been talking to people about how sometimes they'll watch video comics, videotape performances. There's something, you're not there.
Yeah.
And so there's something that you lose the engagement by watching it, whereas the audio, it's like your imagination takes over. So I'm so excited about actually not doing something that you can see.
Yeah, there's something about the album format that's like, to me, it's more exciting because you just make up. I don't know. It's nicer just to hear a voice sometimes. Am I right, audience?
Yeah, that's what they say during your show. I'd like to hear something. I don't know why I put you down. This is my new thing. It's like I'm your Rickles or something.
I like it. Well, I love it. Should I be flattered when people do that? If comedians do that to me, isn't that like an old thing? If someone
Are somebody who it's not that you invite it, but you kind of
yes, he does.
He doesn't. No, we don't. But you know, you're not like a. You're someone at a party who would walk up and go, "Who are you? How are you? I'm Nick. What do you do? I'm
a
comedian.
Name tag.
How are you doing? What's going on?"
It's really weird. I don't understand.
Have they invaded your space sufficiently? No, so you're not like a wallflower.
I'm like somebody who people are like, "This doesn't feel like it should be awkward, but somehow
yeah,
this
you
is
bring
awkward.
A certain awkward yes. sensibility to comedy." Yeah. That makes people in the audience uncomfortable.
Yeah, and
it makes people in the green room
more uncomfortable.
Angry.
But you know what? You're when you mention Rickles, you know, you compare yourself to Rickles. I don't see that that's too far off with you know your state of the industry
speech.
You're
like comedy's Don Rickles, two comedians.
Yes,
I think that's right. But I don't normally. I can get very much into picking on like one. Like my wife said to me, because I'm always joking around with her family, but she was like, she's like the older sister. So I was like needling her younger sister, but funny. But then my wife's like, "Stop doing that. It gets too much.
Why are you
focusing
on
this
one?
You don't want Rickles at a family gathering."
No, you want Rickles, the end of the Rickles album where you're like, "Okay, gang, well, you know, it's a very serious
everybody
time,
loves
and
each
we all
other.
Need to come together and..."
Is we can all make fun
that's
of you.
Rick, your impression of I'm a nice guy?
That's what he does on his records.
Yeah, but he does that in live shows too. Yeah, the thing about Rickles is that he's such a genius, but he's like best everything. I love him. But he's best experience. Also, I think his times have gotten more, whatever you want to call him, politically correct. Mm-hmm. You know, like to me, like Rickles comes from a generation where he might actually have like some kind of like he was on Letterman a month ago talking about the Japanese, and he was basically saying something like it was almost like it was like the day after World War II kind of a joke. You know, the Japanese guy is like, and so Wickle's like, so Letterman's like, okay, he goes, "No, what are you talking about? I go to Mr. Chow's in Los Angeles, and everything's good." And I think Mr. Chow's is Chinese,
right.
But the thing
is
like, so he comes by honestly, but he's also just hilarious. And so, but to me, there's nobody better on panel than Rickles.
He's amazing.
Guys like Rickles would be like a guy that Carson and Letterman, I think, is our. He's different, but he is our Carson. Yeah. I think he's the greatest. And so, but like people will come on and know how to screw around with Dave, like Bill Murray or something like that. That kind of panel is very hard for only a few people can do it because they're like peers of him, and you know Rickles is older, but Rickles would go on Carson and just sit in the chair, and they wouldn't even have no material. They would just say,
and he would even like poke at Johnny too.
Oh, it was unbelievable.
Yeah,
even towards the end of Johnny's like in the last couple of months, he was on panel and Johnny like Fumford over something. He goes, "Watch out there, watch out, Johnny. Every time you stammer, Jay Leno is home high fiving the wife."
Do you find when you poke fun at your peers and other people in the industry. What happens when you meet them?
Well, I have
you inevitably do.
I have a problem because I go after people in a more vicious way that I don't actually like. You know, like I don't like Leno. I don't like what he's done. I think he's like a two-faced kind of a, every anecdote. I made fun because he had this book where it came out where I really believe every anecdote that you hear him say is untrue. That he has something he was saying, like he was in Rome with his wife and he found this wallet on the ground and he's walking around and he's going Franco. He's going Frank. He's like Franco, Franco, Franco. And he can't believe it. Then all of a sudden, the guy comes out of the cafe. He's like, I'm Franco. And I was like, it's a story. It actually happened. First of all, it didn't happen. Secondly of all, why would you be running around going, Franco, I got your wallet. Oh, I'm Franco. Yeah, I see a wallet.
Right.
Yes. Oh, did you say Franco? Waving a large wallet? That's me. Unbelievable. And he used to do these in his book. He would do in his book. He said he has all these stories that like just are total embellished. Yeah. I used to work at a car dealership in Boston. And at the end of the day, one day I brought home, I had all the cash on me, like $10,000 of cash. Why is he going? Why is he leaving with $10,000? And I drove all the way to the Improv in New York. And then I put it on the piano. And then I drove all the way back to Boston. And I left on the piano. I drove back. It was still there. So stories like that, how he picked up a guy in West Hollywood, and he's like, oh, this guy's very friendly here. You know, it turns out to be gay. So I have stories like, I got to the club, and it was flooded. I had to do my act from a canoe!
But is your...
So you've never met Leno?
I have met Leno.
Oh, how'd that go?
Oh, well, this is a story that I literally have told 100 times, but it never kind of gets old, because this is the most embarrassing incident that ever happened with me. My wife's a photographer, and she was doing a shoot, and the mother of the person she was shooting, turns out was a comic. I didn't know she was a comic, and but she did like comic, like she would be like, she was like in her 40s or 50s, and she'd come on stage like with the tights on and do like jokes like with her. What was the thing that Suzanne Summers used to?
Her body?
No, the Thighmaster.
Yeah.
It's like jokes like that. So I found out. So she says she goes out to get some like coffee or something. She goes, hey, Jay Leno's down the street. And his car's broken down. Does anybody want to go look at that? And for some reason, I thought the funniest thing in the world would be to see Jay Leno go, and some big, like, like rice-powered vehicle. So I walk down with her, and she goes, well, do you like Jay Leno? I said, no, I actually don't like him. I make fun of him. He goes, I think he's great. I have a friend who wrote in the show, and then we get to the corner. So he's across the street. She goes, you want to go closer? I say, yeah, I can go closer. And I realize my stomach drops as we're halfway across the street. I realize, oh my God. And she does. She walks right up to Leno. And I just wanted to walk. God. And I walk by them to a place in LA that you would only be walking. It's under a freeway. I would have had to have my car broken down. It's not a store I'm going to. Right. And then I hear her say behind me.
You're like running from the Terminator. She's
running from the Terminator. Yeah. And so I hear her behind me. And she's telling him. Who I am. And he's like, Andy Kindler. And so then I walk back sheepishly, and he goes, yeah, that's the guy who hates me. And then she starts going, why do you, I just told her the story. She goes, why do you hate him?
In front of Jay Leno.
And Jay Leno. I said, no. And Jay Leno goes, it's okay to hate.
That's very...
And it was so embarrassing.
Did it feel surreal or too real?
Well, it felt like I was just, ridiculous. Yeah. Why am I walking by him? The stupidest thing I've ever done. But I also introduced him at a benefit once at the Improv.
Uh-huh.
And I said, ladies and gentlemen, you may recognize this next performer from The Tonight Show. And then he whispers in my ear, he goes, hey, this kills you, doesn't it? It kills you.
Oh, my God.
Well, I was privy to a moment in Montreal where Dane Cook came over.
Well, that's the perfect example.
Yes.
Because I've been making fun of him for years. But it was like, you know, like with Dane Cook, it's not really personal animus. It's just making fun of his career and everything.
Yeah.
So he walked by. So I was like, hey, Dane Cook.
Yeah.
And he goes, oh, Andy. And he was like, very nice. Because I hear he's, even with like Neil Hamburger, he's more like, he wants to be more gracious about being made fun of?
Yeah, or it's like he recognizes maybe that his inner workings are not being killed by this criticism. It's more like who he is in comedy. How is that for a bunch of words?
No, that made total sense.
No, I understood that.
And then he followed me, so I'm following him, and then
yeah.
Occasionally he'll pitch like ideas. You go, I'm doing this show with Andy Kindler. And
you mean on Twitter? You're
following each other? And I go, yeah, it's great. And we're pitching it, and people will be like, what? I can't believe this, Kindler. What are you doing? And then like Dane's fans will go, hey, this is great. Good luck with your buddy cop show. Right. But the thing is, it depends on what I'm saying. So like what I'm saying about him is not the end of the world. You know, in terms of it really is like roast style jokes.
Right.
But when I went after Adam Carolla this year and called him a racist, and you know,
there's no turning back.
I would never want to see him anywhere. I don't want to see him. I was on his podcast. What triggered it was I was on his podcast, and I was on there twice. And the second time, I had the worst experience of my life. And it's just like he doesn't even know there's other human beings. He's just the most self-absorbed guy I've ever seen. So no, I have no desire ever to see him. I don't want to confront the people on a personal level. People, I think, because like he does talk about Mexicans, they think, well, maybe that's not like talking about black people. It's the definition of racism when you define a whole country. They're swarming over the border. They don't have our values, he says. He did a whole thing about how, you know, black people complain about not getting picked up by cabs. And then he goes, but you know what? These people who are driving the cabs, they're not even they're from another country. So how could it be us who's doing it? But then he doesn't stop there. And then he goes, and maybe these people driving the cabs know something about black people, about why they shouldn't get picked up. I mean, it's really literally off the charts hate speech. And his fans love it. They don't want to admit because they say it's the truth.
But it's also comedy. Right, like it's also couched as comedy, so
that,
it's just this tricky
that
thing.
Line.
And
yeah.
that's my major point. He's not a comedian, so he really is. He thinks he is, but he's not. Maybe he was on Loveline or something, but currently he's using the guise of a comedian as an excuse to engage in horrible hate speech.
I mean, when is the line between like, ha ha, everybody's getting this, this is funny, and this is like a bad, this is like bad preaching? You know what I mean?
Well, you can't make any rules. Like I always use the Dave Attell example of, you know, within a minute, Dave Attell will use every word that I wouldn't use in my act.
Yeah.
He's hilarious. So I always say, like, if you're hilarious, I can really, even if I don't agree, like with Attell, he'll get upset about, like, groups of, like, he does jokes about, I would never use the word midget, but he uses the thing, all of a sudden he's angry at midgets, but it's like, to me, it's hilarious because it's so ridiculous. That if I don't know what's motivating him, but ultimately it's so ludicrous that someone would be angry and then saying all these things. So, but he's a genius. So
yes.
I feel like if you're hilarious, I don't really care unless you're really like you know doing Roundup the Jews material and seriously. But if you're funny, then there's no all bets are off. At least Dennis Miller is as odious a human being, as a despicable as a human being he is. But he's clearly saying, I'm a right wing talk radio host now. This is what I'm doing. Carolla doesn't say that.
He doesn't make a distinction.
No, I'm just a comedian.
I'm a
comedian. But meanwhile, he's on. They has Roland with Carolla on the O'Reilly Factor.
Roland with Carolla?
Yeah, he hates people. Carolla hates people who take food stamps because he's angry at his own family because he grew up poor and he apparently talks so poorly about his mother. I don't know what happened there, but so he thinks that nobody should be using food stamps, which is just ignorance of reality that there are poor people in the United States who are working poor.
Yeah,
and food stamps is one of the most beneficial programs because it not only helps people who can't afford to eat, it injects money into the economy. People use it at supermarkets who make money. So he's like just ignorantly angry.
Yeah, not everyone's
I'm just trying to wrap my head around this food stamps economy thing.
Because it's for every dollar you invest that you give someone, if you give someone cash, here's cash from the government, then they go back and spend that money in a supermarket It helps the economy.
Helps the supermarket.
I get it, Andy.
It helps the economy.
I'm with
was
you.
That a bit?
I think it was something. I was trying to do something with that.
Oh, but you didn't quite understand.
I didn't quite understand it either because I'm a little tired today.
But also, not everyone's trying to rip off the system when it comes to food stamps,
but that's
which
like
is, I think, where that stems from, right?
Right, but they used to say that. I mean, Reagan was the famous for increasing the whole anger at any kind of social programs because he was like, you know, welfare queens driving Cadillacs. It is true that Lyndon Baines Johnson, you know, LBJ, he tried and he had horrible sides to him like Vietnam, but he was trying to cure poverty. And in the case where they did, when they made it like more beneficial financially to stay on welfare than to take a job, then people were abusing the system because that's the way the system was set up. And there's abuse in every program, but food stamps, you know, what are you going to say, like, oh, they used it to buy beer? I don't know if they can use it to buy beer. But it's also the right wing. I mean, I'm just enraged at the right wing now because they're so terrible. But, like, you know, they tried to portray the 2008 recession as poor people, you know, they shouldn't have been buying those homes. Well, nobody should have been giving them those loans. Those people giving them those loans were making money on the loan. And my father said when he was, you know, buying a house, you couldn't get a loan. Like right now, I'm trying to get a loan to buy something. They are scrutinizing everything because I'm self-employed.
Right.
How did it get to the point where they were just able to give out these liar loans? Yeah. You know, they would just ask, what do you make? Well, we'll say you make $100,000 a year. So, but they're constantly trying to focus on the poor people, like it's their fault or what they're doing. And that it's like the recession was like almost like a depression. And there are so many people who are working poor and our minimum wage is so low. So it's just it's a phony argument that appeals to people like Adam Carolla.
Why don't you should have like a political, why don't you do a political talk show? That's the second life of Andy Kindler is, you're the new Olbermann.
Well, I'm not very articulate. Well, I hate NBC, it's like I hate MSNBC.
Maybe that's your thing.
That I hate everything?
No, you're inarticulate. You're inarticulate.
I think that is my thing. I just stretch it out to another field. But, like, people love MSNBC. It's like, I think MSNBC is, in a lot of ways, they're worse than Fox, because at least Fox, you know, it's complete bullshit. It's propaganda. They're not hiding it, although they claim to hide it, but they're laughing when they say fair and balanced. MSNBC, they're like, they think they're revolutionaries. Here's my big problem. When you think that, by definition, politicians are all thieves and criminals, and there's no politician who's not, then you're saying that you are morally superior to somebody else just based on their profession, as if there aren't, like, people on MSNBC, they don't have their own agendas. They're trying to build their own followings. You know, you could say that about anybody's profession.
But that's like cynicism, right? Essentially. That's cynicism. I never really thought of cynicism in that sense of being like, it actually is you being trying to be superior, trying to get one over on people, judging, like, to, you know, or stepping out of, like, I don't know, excusing yourself from participating, being above it, you know?
Right, because then you could just say it's all terrible. But that's the interesting thing about Twitter is, you know, like Bob Dylan said, like, at some award thing, there's going to be times in your life when everybody's going to be against you. And that's the thing you have to accept at one point. Like, you want to build, like, on Twitter, you build a following, and, you know, but if you get too involved in people who are on your side, you start to cede your own point of view or get too affected by other people's point of view, because the world is not based on everything that I want to have happen. It's just not going to happen. So there's a certain level where, in the old days, without all this social media, you could get you wouldn't get as enraged. And then sometimes I can't watch the news for a week or 2 weeks because I'm not helping. It's not helping me to that I can see every tragedy on the planet instantly beamed on a website. It's not healthy. It's not good for humankind.
I don't have a television. But not by choice.
Are you serious?
Well, only because, like, I've been moving around, like,
But you have things on your web.
We didn't have the internet for like 2 weeks in my place.
Really?
I was freaking out.
Are you a Luddite?
I'm a Mennonite. Do you know about Mennonites?
No.
It's a Canadian thing.
They're like
Amish in Canada.
The Amish of Canada.
That's the show, Amish in Canada.
When you mentioned the whole Dylan thing where, you know, not everybody...
He's mentioned Dylan three times, though. We're breaking the comedy rule of threes if we go...
Well, no, I'm just saying that Dylan was just talking about going electric.
Well...
That's all it was.
No, but here's the thing. Like, I'm reading what's it called? The
Chronicles?
Yeah, it's unbelievable. They're just so great. It's amazing.
Is it written by him?
It's written by him. No, it's clearly written by him. Because
When that came out, I haven't read it because I didn't know if it was him.
Oh, no, it's completely him. You hear his, after a while, have you ever heard him host that Bob Dylan theme time radio hour? It's amazing. Because he has this kind of cadence. Back in the Depression times, they were like, and so I'm reading the book, I was on the Berkeley Street, and so I'm reading the book in his voice.
Right.
And said all he talks about, the people who was, I think it was called Sing Out or one of these folk magazines that turned on, these people were, there was a limited worldview. Mm-hmm. You can't stop someone from growing musically. If you look back on it, it's like ludicrous. And to me, he probably is the bravest person ever, because whatever, however he deals with life, I am firmly convinced he had no, I would have had much more fear and have had much more fear when everyone's against me. Mm-hmm. I don't think he cared.
I think it's easy and flippant for me to just say, well, he just went electric. But going back and taking it in context, going electric back then was like...
Or anything he did, the any expectations they had of him. Their expectations was he's going to be singing about issues.
But and he was the first guy of that right, everybody put.
Well, he wasn't the first guy. He was just that one, the one everyone pinned. And so when you realize this guy's scope is actually a little bigger than just, you know, the Hattie Carroll or Hollis Brown and all that stuff. Then, saving the world or providing songs for other people to sing, which is, like, how he got really famous, too, right? It's like, I guess people got freaked out, scared, you know? He's not theirs. He's not only theirs. He doesn't just belong to them.
And, sometimes, you know. I watch the footage of when he went electric and the reactions of audience members, and I wish someone would just, like, find those people.
And see how they feel now.
And how they feel now.
Isn't that true of any... fan of any band or anything? That's more true of bands than even comedians, because you know I'm not likely to come out and all of a sudden be banging on a conga drum, you know. So, but you might change your style and be like, I like the other thing. But like an artist, that's death to an artist, to just to give people what they think or what they want. And but the thing is like he loved Woody Guthrie. So that's the thing. When you read the Chronicles, he was in love with Woody Guthrie. That was his hero. So he loved the folk songs that went all the way back in time as stories. He wasn't particular. He loved to sing about, you know, pirates and everything. It's like, yeah. It wasn't that he didn't care about like Hurricane Carter later on or all these people, but that wasn't his thing. You notice he wasn't at Woodstock. He wasn't involved in like a lot of protests against the war. I mean, I love that John Lennon was, but that just wasn't him. But they wanted him to be that
right,
guy.
Right.
You know.
I mean, isn't that a thing where the most iconic people don't really follow what people want? Like over the, if you kind of like look at these people, whether it's like Richard Pryor or like Dave Chappelle or Bob Dylan or Neil Young, like they all kind of do their own
thing. And that's the thing. It's like, you know, nobody wants to be like, I don't want to be known as the guy who just talks about the industry, because I don't just want to talk about the industry.
Well, that's a very reductive look at what you do, because there's a reason why you are someone who can talk about the industry.
Right.
You
know what I mean? It's not like it's because I'm actually talking about what I'm involved in as opposed to picking it third hand.
You're very reactive too. Like you're really present as a person in a comic. So I think that has almost everything to do with like reacting to the comics around you. You know what I mean? Like the world around you. And I also, I don't, maybe I'm wrong here, but it seems like you talked about that thing with like being, you know, in a world of giants when you were growing up, like the Beatles and Rolling Stones. Maybe you just hold everything to a pretty high standard.
Well, even like you were talking about before, about why don't I do a, you know, we were joking, like why don't I do a political show? But the thing I did like Politically Incorrect a couple of times years and years ago. And the thing about it is, like, when you're on TV and you're just excited that you're on TV, mm-hmm. so there's something that becomes unreal about these arguments that you're having,
mm-hmm.
and I think almost like your humanity gets cut off.
How about this politics and more
with Andy Kindler
and more? That's going to be a really wide open subject that you can
use the hook and then expand it.
Yeah, exactly.
Here's my fear, which I think is a reality of me, is that I do have, and a lot of comics have it, but I have a bad case of Robin Williams syndrome, where it all becomes about you. So I constantly have to not edit myself of what I'm saying, but I have to, because I'm very bad when I think, it's not that I think I know everything, but I think I know everything. So, like, you know, I'm ready. You're talking, and I'm like, oh, well, I don't know, let me top his thing. So that's what I always feel somewhat bad, because I, even in an interview where maybe you could say ostensibly it's about me, but it's not. So it flew by, but still with me agonizing that when this comes out, it'll be all me going blah, 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 blah. If I looked at me in a positive way, I think I am one of those comics.
Which you should.
Yeah, but I'm one of those comics. If we're all sitting, standing around, mm-hmm. I will. Kind of, I can get everybody going in a funny way, but there are the comics who are brilliant comics, but they're more shy, or mm-hmm. they're not, that's not their thing, And I notice sometimes even when I'm getting everybody going, I'm having the greatest time, like I'll miss something that someone's saying quietly. So it's always a battle to turn off the ego.
You know, I noticed that thing that you noticed about yourself and Nick.
Oh, you mean the schlubby Jewish, did I say schlubby?
You're not schlubby.
No, no, but you see, you're considered handsome. I always thought of myself looking like you. That's but now people say, no, I'm handsome. But now I'm probably looking at you like I would look at me. Yeah, what is this? Mr. Jew entered the room?
I'm only half Jewish. My father is Irish.
So what was your, did you have a, remember your tour that you did, Jewgasm?
Yeah, I do remember Jewgasm. I did that with Ari Shaffir.
He reminds me of me because he's got that kind of, an awkward quality to him that I think is very amusing.
Thank you.
He amuses me. Bring me Nick Flanagan.
Well, that was my favorite thing. I think it wasn't the first time we met, but it was close to it when I interviewed you at Just for Laughs, the video interview or something, and right. you were like, I can't really put my finger on the energy you're putting out. It's not negative, right. but it's something weird. You know?
Yeah, it's weird. It's a Woody Allen. It goes back to Woody Allen type thing.
Yeah,
look at you.
You tried to turn this into a thing where here I am, I'm a self-obsessed megalomaniac.
No, I meant the early movies. Oh, hey. They're just jokes.
Yeah, like something that hasn't aged well.
Take the money and run. Yeah.
Nick, we did it. Nick tried to get a podcast going once, and you came over to my place to do it, and it was called
Help Me Comedy.
So I was supposed to give him advice on how to
Then we brought in Tim Gilbert, was the first guest. My friend, comedian Tim Gilbert.
How do you pay the rent? That's what everybody wants to know.
I write animation.
Wow,
yeah.
You do?
Yeah, I'm an animation.
What kind of animated things do you
write? Kid stuff, you know, like a show called Oh No that just went on the air, but aliens versus kids, and wrote some of a show called The Day My Butt Went Psycho. You know, lots of farting. You do voices on kids' shows.
I do voices on kids' shows.
You have a great voice for that.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Andy. Or I can do this one. Hi. Or I can do an old Jew. How I'm old and I'm Jewish.
What would that character be animated?
Hey, kids.
Kids, get off my lawn.
What is that?
Let's kill him.
Is that a duck or is that a parrot?
No, I don't do it. When I was a kid, I never watched Warner Brothers, and I feel bad about it now, but I never, for some reason, I was like, that guy's, are they making fun of speech impediments? They'd be like, I don't know.
Sensitive.
Snagglepuss.
Yeah, Snagglepuss. I watched Hanna-Barbera, which is
much worse.
It's much worse, but I saw them as like good like sitcoms for a kid. Yeah.
Like they all had these sort of kind voices. Yeah,
Snagglepuss.
Yeah, exactly. Snagglepuss is droopy, you know?
Was David he Hanna-Barbera? Goliath was your favorite.
Yeah, it converted me to Christianity. It was really early Jews for Jesus stuff that I loved. Hey, is that a Jew, Davy? Let's teach him of the Lord.
The dog is the most anti-Semitic dog.
There is something you can really picture him.
I loved that show when I was a kid. I didn't know it was
It was hauntingly made.
Religious?
Yeah, it was hauntingly religious. I do think that the religious aspect did give it this eeriness, you know. And it was kind of beautiful. Like claymation was a very interesting art form.
That's right. You know? It was. It looked great.
And stop motion. You know,
for some reason it reminded me of candy.
Yeah,
I wanted to
eat
them.
Because you mean the Davy and Goliath?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they weren't also. I don't remember them being heavy-handed. Like
It was more
like just general. To me, like I realized recently, I came to the realization that you can't argue. There's no intellectual argument for atheism. There's no scientific argument for it. It's simply like I feel a certain connection through music drugs that the character Andy Kindler did in college for insurance purposes, where you feel like you're transcending reality. And so that's not something I desire to prove, or I know what it means. I just sense it. So how can you argue with people who are making a completely non-scientific thing? They're saying there is no God. You know, if you press them on it, they'll go, well, of course, I don't know what you can know. But why do you think you know? Well, you think you know because you see other things die, and you think that it's just there's no real science to it. And the fact that scientists are so like Dawkins and all these people, mm-hmm. it makes me not want to listen to their science.
Yeah.
Because if they're that stupid about spirituality, Maybe they're missing something as a scientist. You know, it's like Einstein was not that way, and he was. Some people just like Jonathan Katz is a brilliant comic. He just doesn't believe in God, and maybe if I explained, you know, if I said what, you know, spiritual things, he wouldn't reject them. But it just doesn't. If you're fine living your life, but you have a belief that doesn't inhibit your life, I don't care what you believe. But I'm talking about these angry people who like. You know, like Penn Jillette, they say you can't use the word, you know, I have faith that something will work out. And there's no faith. You know, it's like they're aggressively telling you you're wrong.
How about Ricky Gervais?
He is the worst human being now. He's just a terrible human being on every level. He's a terrible person. And you can tell how terrible he is on his Twitter feed. His Twitter feed is just him promoting Derek. He goes, I can't believe the North American reviews have been fantastic. 2 days later, the New York Times slams it. And slams him for saying it's an exclusive to Netflix because it's been released everywhere else. Oh. And he's just so that character he did in the original Office was the I loved him it's so much. Yeah. He has, but that he thinks he's a stand-up comic because he's done it 20 times.
Yeah.
His ego is covering up deep insecurity because if half your Twitter feed is saying I don't care what people think, that means of course you care what people think. You would only need to say that once. Right. If it was not something you were struggling with.
Right.
But he's actually got to put it in his little bio thing, the one word thing. I don't care what you think. Email me.
Yeah, and then people, who was making fun of his profile pic last night?
Was it Mark Maron? Mark Maron.
Yeah, like he's like, that laugh of his. Oh. So anyway,
It's very effective. I mean, I noticed the Gervais laugh is a thing. It's very affected.
You can't tell, but Andy is away from the microphone, just as he pointed out at the beginning of the podcast.
But I even like that the thing he originally did with Carl Pilkington. I like that. Love that podcast.
Yeah. The original one.
Yeah, but now I can't even listen to that because it's like people have pointed out, like Tom Sharpling has pointed out that, you know, he's like abusing this guy, Carl.
Oh, yeah.
It's like saying, this guy could die in a volcano on this show or something like that. And then do you think he'll finally realize that he's picking on people?
It'll be too late.
But is Carl in on the joke? That's another thing.
I think he is somewhat in on the joke. I think he is in on the joke, but it's so much of it is based on abusing him.
Yeah, of course.
You know, quote, lack of intelligence.
We're giving the signal.
It was my fault. My bad.
Our fault.
My bad.
It's fun talking.
How do we wrap this up?
Oh.
How do we wrap this up, Andy?
What have we learned? What do we conclude from all this? Nick, what do you say would sum up the podcast in one sentence that we can pitch?
Andy Kindler has opinions about a lot of things.
And more.
He also
run-on sentence.
He also enjoys run-on sentences, comma, and coffee.
And also, whatever I hate, you should hate. Whatever I like, you should agree with me. And then there'll be no problems. You know, I just want to say, I want to thank the people at Blue, and Blue Microphone.
And Vans.
I love, you know what Vans. I love? Have you seen the Skull Candy? Have you people seen that?
They're wonderful. The Skull really Candy wonderful. Earbuds and hair phones.
Do you have a Danko Jones DVD? I have one.
I might have one. I still haven't figured out if I have one.
He doesn't know if he has one.
I have the book. The book's great.
Why don't we do one of these things where we fade out, like where the conversation continues.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
Yeah, and then we were all having so much fun.
Thanks, Andy.
Yeah, it's really going to be a great time. Yeah, no, we didn't even explain that it was a Just for Laughs.